And for at least two sessions, if not three, I'm going to be discussing with you some of the Palestinians' achievements through the Intifada. Today we will talk primarily about the uprising, which I see as a nonviolent resistance movement for the most part, involving the entire population of the occupied territories. And tomorrow, in a session at 10:45 entitled Searchers for a Just Peace, I will share with you some of the portraits of both Jews and Palestinians who are working for a just peace in the Middle East. And I'd also like to take the opportunity to tell you about some of the recommendations that our delegation, which was sponsored by the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America and the Lutheran World Federation, some of those recommendations that we made as a result of our trip, and discuss them with you, see what you think of them, as well as discuss other questions that you have from both presentations. And finally, on Wednesday evening, Grant Abbott, who is here, would you just raise your hand, Grant? And he's talking this week about the Jewish-Christian dialogue. He and I will join Barbara Rossing in a forum, and that's where we will have our chance to discuss many different perspectives. This afternoon, I'm going to be using a prepared speech. This is very uncustomary for me. I normally speak off the cuff and I lead discussions. But I'm doing this because the material is so dense with information and so on that I feel it's best to get it into this small package. So please bear with me. It's time to begin now, and I'm Jan Bowman, and the title of my talk is Palestinians and the Intifada, Casting Off and Putting On. Among the books lined up on my desk like a yardstick, reminding me of the measure of human experience, is a slim volume by Elie Wiesel, many of you have read it, called Night. In this little book, Wiesel, who was taken by the Nazis to Auschwitz as a boy, records the unimaginable evil, the depths of human depravity which he experienced both in that concentration camp and later at Buchenwald. Never shall I forget that night, he writes, the first night in camp, which has turned my life into one long night, seven times cursed and seven times sealed. Never shall I forget that smoke. Never shall I forget the faces of the children whose bodies I saw turned into wreaths of smoke beneath a silent blue sky. Elie Wiesel has spoken twice at California Lutheran University, where I teach. And on the first of these occasions, I sat in the front row. I was just that close. His eyes seemed to be sunk into dark wells of nightmare, recalling for me the last line of Night, which describes the author's first glimpse of himself in a mirror after he left Buchenwald. He sees the face of a corpse. He was 15 years old. In January, I met another man with nightmarish memories. His name is Otto Rantisi, and he was born in Lydda, one of the communities where the Apostle Peter spread the good news about Jesus and healed the lame. Otto Rantisi is an Episcopalian priest. When he was a small boy, his family and he were evicted from their home by Zionist soldiers and marched with thousands of others from Lydda into a mountain pass, through that pass and into a closed canyon where soldiers shot bullets over their heads in order to intimidate them. It was July and extremely hot. For 3 days they remained like cattle, waiting uncertainly in a pen. without food or water. When the soldiers finally returned and started shooting into the crowd, 3,000 to 4,000 people had already died of exposure. The survivors fled to the East Bank, where olive trees became makeshift homes. After 3 months, the Red Cross came with tents. Later, these people and thousands of others like them from all over the land were resettled in refugee camps. The refugee camps, to this day, are the temporary home, of Palestinians whose land was confiscated by the Israelis both in 1947-48 and later in 1967. Some people suggest that the sufferings of Wiesel, a Jew, and Rantisi, a Palestinian, are connected. This school of thought focuses on the fear many Jews hold that the Holocaust will be repeated. Jewish theologian Mark Ellis declares, for example, that Holocaust theology is the normative theology of the Jewish community today. This theology views the Jews as a suffering and helpless people who must reverse a long history of anti-Semitism through acts of empowerment. And I must pause here to say that this is, if you will, theology made policy by the foreign ministry. We heard two members of the foreign ministry articulate this policy. The cost of that empowerment, however, needs to be analyzed, according to Ellis, and I quote, "Holocaust theology speaks eloquently about the struggle for human dignity in the death camps and radically about the question of God and Jewish survival, but it has virtually nothing to say about the ethics of a Jewish state possessing nuclear weapons, supplying military arms and assistance to authoritarian regimes, and expropriating land and torturing children," end quote. In January, I witnessed the cost of that empowerment in Israel and the occupied territories, chiefly as a price being paid by the Palestinians, but also by the Jews themselves. While the situation could be viewed as a classic case of the cycles of abuse, in which the victim, you know, must eventually work out his or her pain by becoming the victimizer, I reject that analysis because it only leads us to futility and despair. Instead, I think that some people in Israel have allowed their passion for security, their security-mindedness, to rule over every other passion, including the most important passion, as I see it, compassion. In depending on military might to bring peace to their country, they have become fearful and distrustful creatures, lashed to the side of a paranoid ship which will take them far from true peace. These people, the members of the rightist foreign ministry, the military leaders of the state and their supporters, do not represent even a majority of the Israelis, many of whom remember the suffering of the Holocaust to be sure, but vow as a consequence never again to cause another human being that kind of pain. Instead, the leadership in Israel today represents what I call the archaic minded of the world, who are so lacking in imagination and true fortitude that they seek military solutions to every conflict and persist in using an iron fist even when the table for negotiations has been set. And we know now that Arafat has accepted UN resolutions 224 and 338. I may have screwed those up. You know the resolutions I'm talking about. At any rate, that this is as if he is saying, come to the table, and the invitation is being refused. Mark Ellis goes on in his article to advocate that Holocaust theology should be confronted by solidarity, a reaching out to other communities in a gesture of goodwill, and simultaneously a probing of one's own community. That's a very important aspect of solidarity, I think. In Israel proper, there are no less than 60 peace groups, from the well-known Peace Now and Yesh Gavul to the lesser known SHANE, which is an acronym for Israeli Women's Alliance Against the Occupation. Recently, in a show of solidarity, these women members of SHANE camped for a week at Ansar 3, which is the notoriously inhumane prison camp in the Negev. Perhaps you've heard about it. The temperatures are so extreme that it has been pronounced uninhabitable for human beings. Well, that's a rather lengthy introduction to my talk, but at any rate, I'd like to go on now by telling you about some of the things that the delegation of six who went, sponsored by the ELCA and LWF in January, what we saw and what our purpose was. Our purpose was to help the Lutheran Church shape a response to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and recommend actions which might contribute to a just peace in the area. Although we concentrated on observing conditions in the occupied territories and talking to Palestinians both inside and outside the refugee camps, we also met with Israeli Jews, from rightist military authorities and foreign ministers to leftist peace activists and politicians. We also met with many church officials, particularly those of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan. And it may come as a surprise to some of you that the Lutheran Church has six congregations there and five schools as well as two boarding homes. Our dominant impression after 3.5 weeks in the area is the subject of my talk. We learned that the Intifada, or uprising, is not about throwing stones, as the media has us believe. It is instead about casting off and putting on. In Arabic, Intifada literally means casting off or shaking off the dust that burdens you. You know the passage, I believe, in Matthew, where Jesus tells his disciples, when you come to a town and say peace and no one welcomes you, then shake the dust off your feet and go to another town. Well, the word has that same root. And the Christians, the Palestinian Christians, often refer to that Bible verse when they speak of the Intifada. The dust in this case is certainly the burden of subjugation by the Israelis, the daily harassment by soldiers who may pursue your son as he is peddling home from doing an errand for you, as the Tarazi boy experienced in peddling home from buying fruit for his mother, pursued by soldiers in a jeep. He peddled faster, went down an alleyway, knocked on a door seeking sanctuary, was admitted, hid under the bed where a grandmother was sitting. The soldiers pursued him, beat the grandmother until they saw his feet under the bed, dragged him out to the jeep, away into a field where they beat him to death. The same thing has happened to Christian and Muslim Palestinians alike. Or it may mean that El Salvadoran-type death squads, Palestinian or Israeli soldiers disguised as Palestinians, in stolen Palestinian vehicles, going into the villages in the middle of the night and arousing you and your family in order to take off your son who has been suspected of subversive activities. Or it may be a collective type of punishment where all of you men in this room, are aroused in the middle of the night and told to strip to your underwear and then stand around a cesspool, a huge cesspool in Jabalia refugee camp, to stand there for hours in the freezing cold, and if you utter a word of complaint, you are pushed into this stinking mess. Collective punishments are very, very common. Intifada certainly means a shaking off of the dust of high taxes with which you pay for your own occupation, but give you few or no social services, including decent medical care. It may mean, if you're a student at the university or an author, shedding the burden of censorship and the banning of books. If you're a student at Birzeit University, for example, you are not permitted to read journals in Arabic, your own language. You may read anything you want in German or French, but not Arabic, whereas at the Hebrew University on Mount Scopus, the students are permitted to read Arabic journals. It means that you can't buy literature or read literature in your own language, and if you should dare to write literature in your own language, you may be deported. Intifada, however, refers more than to the shaking off of Israeli occupation. It also refers to shaking off a kind of inner occupation of the Palestinian people. Now, this runs very deep and may be unfamiliar to most of you here. Palestinian people for a long time have lacked self-confidence and national identity, a kind of problem which has psychologically oppressed them. They have been depicted as nomads who have never developed the land, and then Israel came and made the desert bloom, you've all heard that. As a people of warring tribal and religious factions, as Arab terrorists with Kalashnikovs in their hands and stockings over their faces, as Muslim extremists determined to wage another jihad or holy war, and as defeated refugees who have neither a home nor a future. Although there may be an element of truth, and I will grant you that there is, in each of these stereotypes or depictions, all are distortions of the larger, complex truth, and they need to be opened up by other images. In the past 18 months, since the Intifada began in December of 87, the Palestinians have been casting off these denigrating images and asserting their right to put on images of human dignity and self-determination. We have not been treated as human beings, said Pastor Rantisi to me, not even as animals who do have some rights, but as insects to be crushed. Menachem Begin called us grasshoppers. In Israel, menial labor is called Arab work, just as we once talked about nigger work. And school children will say to one another, your drawing looks like an Arab drawing, or you play soccer like an Arab, in order to be spurious to one another. We were told that if the leaders of the PLO were to call off the Intifada tomorrow, it would continue up its own momentum. It began as a grassroots movement, and it is now it involves every single member of the population. I think I can say that with conviction. So it is not likely to go away tomorrow. I'd like to emphasize, because I want to show some slides in a minute which will detail a few of the human rights abuses for you, but before I do that, I want to emphasize some of the positive social changes that have come out of the Intifada. I think it's important to recognize these, because we're talking this summer about embracing the contraries, and we know that often in very painful, oppressive situations, there is still a positive element, some sign of hope. In this case, I would say that this casting off of a self-denigrating image is the most positive thing that could happen to the Palestinian people, and the beginning that I see of a building of a state. You know, a state must happen as far as the Palestinians are concerned, and the only solution is a two-state solution. So they are beginning now to build the services that you must have in a state. They've never developed these services in their entire history, because they've always been occupied by one country or another, or they've been subjected to one set of rulers or another. Well, what are some of these social changes? That actually, some of them will seem almost humorous or ridiculous to you, but that's all right. Palestinians are raising goats, chickens, and rabbits in order to become more economically self-sufficient. The acting president, the real one has been deported, of Birzeit University has a garden like almost everyone else. These activities, innocuous as they seem, are illegal. The former dean, academic dean of Bethlehem University, was imprisoned for distributing seeds, tomato seeds. The Palestinians see these measures, however, as the first step in achieving economic independence from Israel. Colorful posters proclaiming buy local appear everywhere. And the real message, of course, is boycott Israeli products. Israelis' trade figures released a couple of months ago show the impact. Surplus exports to the West Bank and Gaza fell to $56 million in 1988 from $174 million the previous year. Or to put it in shorthand, exports to the West Bank fell more than 50% in 1988. Tourism is down 65%. Some of you have said this week that you'd like to go to the Holy Land. You know that you're taking some risks in going. It's not exactly the best time to go there from one perspective. From another, from mine, it is the best time to go. But at any rate, tourism is a very big business in this part of the country, and it's down 65%. The U.S. Embassy has estimated that costs direct and indirect to the Israelis of the Intifada go over $2 billion. I met a young woman who acts as a manager of the West Bank's only exporting firm, only one exporting firm. She told me about her firm's difficulty in obtaining a license to import the Chinese silk fabric that they use to make lingerie, which they then sell to boutiques in London and New York. Knowing that they could never receive a license for exporting the goods, they do so illegally. While I was visiting her, there was an alarm. The soldiers are coming, the soldiers. And believe me, I grabbed my tape recorder and my camera and I stuffed them in my pockets and I was prepared as anyone for the soldiers. They didn't come, but they are daily, of course, exposed to this possibility, and the director of that firm has been deported. Sawa will probably be next. But at any rate, the important thing for her is that she has made the attempt. A 29-year-old young woman has made the attempt to help her country, her people, she doesn't really have a country, become more self-sufficient by beginning to export goods. You've heard about the closure of the schools, and this, as I was just reading in the Christian Science Monitor, the most recent one at the Village, an editorial I'd like to share with you by Stanley Cohen, who teaches at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, is entitled Education as a Crime in the West Bank. And in this article, he, a Jew, suggests that the Israeli authorities are offending every kind of legal convention in the world, from the Fourth Geneva Convention to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in denying these children, kindergarten through university, an education. Now, I know that despite these closures, you know, they close the school because they think that schools or any place of assembly are hotbeds of unrest. You know, it's where people get together and decide what they're going to do. I know that schooling is going on in Palestine. It's going on in what they call the neighborhood or popular schools, alternative schools. But the teachers conduct those classes at great risk. If you are discovered, even passing out homework assignments, which the parents can then help their children with at home, you may be imprisoned for 10 years, some say now 25. And at Lutheran High School in Ramallah, I met a young woman who is teaching physics in her own home, which is very dangerous. You should never teach in your own home. She's been in prison several times and is willing to go back for the sake of those children. Why? Well, education is the most precious commodity for Palestinians, and you can figure this out on your own. Anyone? Why should education be their most precious commodity?
You can't take it away.
You can't take it away. It's an inalienable investment. You can have your land, your property, your goods, you can have all that taken away, but you cannot take away this knowledge or the skills that you've developed in higher education, and it's exportable or importable, or however you want to put it, which leads us to consider a further problem. As with most countries where there's a lot of oppression, there's a tremendous brain drain, and more Palestinians are coming to the United States, they're going to Egypt, and so on. I wanted, to be sure that you got the point that even though schools are being closed, education in many ways is being continued. And that's important because Palestinians, for the first time, are not subjecting themselves to the kind of education that they've always had to follow. Even under the Jordanian Ministry of Education, they were told exactly what to teach in their curriculum. And that curriculum essentially obliterated the history and culture of the Palestinian people. Now they are developing, through a special project called Educational Awareness and Involvement, a Palestinian curriculum. They're studying their own culture and history. And this pilot project is being used at the Lutheran schools in what I now call Palestine. Healthcare is another area in which tremendous strides are being made. Again, before the Intifada, the Palestinians were completely dependent upon an Israeli healthcare system, which sometimes would or would not admit them as patients. Rita Jackamon, who heads the Department of Community Health at Brzezet University, told us about a revolutionary model called primary health. Healthcare. Do any of you know what that means, primary healthcare? It means that you take the health to the village rather than asking the villagers to come to a centralized location like a hospital. And so they go with mobile units, completely equipped to do trauma work, to deliver babies, really almost anything one needs. And they're also training village women primarily to be midwives and nurses and so on. The Intifada probably wouldn't still be on its feet if they didn't have this mobile health delivery system, because, as you know, there have been more than 22,000 injuries, not to mention the 400 plus deaths since the beginning of the Intifada, and they couldn't possibly take care of all of those people if they had to bring them to hospitals. Midwifery is very important because if you had to go to a hospital across the Green Line, that is into Israel proper, to deliver your baby, you must not wait until after midnight to deliver the baby because you would offend the curfew. You need to get back home, you know. So women plan to deliver your babies before midnight or don't do so at all. Now, I need to say that many of these services are being developed by women, and it's not exactly because women got the great idea to do so, it was necessity. It's always the mother of invention, right? The men, by the thousands, are being deported, imprisoned, injured, and killed. And so the women have had to take up the reins, as it were, and lead this society. And I think it's very interesting what the women are choosing to do. You know, that primarily they're working on healthcare and education. There's a new women's movement in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip called the Palestinian Women's Committees. And they have revolutionized what was once, what is still called, women's charitable societies. The kind of work that goes on here, too, in the United States, where women in perhaps YWCA-affiliated or church-affiliated projects do charitable work, sponsor daycare centers and so on. Palestinian women's committees instead are going to the villages and asking the women what their needs are, what their problems are. And for instance, if they say, these biscuits that the Israelis sell us are too costly, then they start a biscuit factory, and because they're going to work in the biscuit factory, they need a daycare center, so they begin to have that too. And then they say, but we really want to be with our children, and so they initiate flex time in the biscuit factory. And so all of these projects, again, building for a future state, have come out of the Intifada. They seem rather fragile. As one author of a magazine put it, magazine article put it, how can 10 eggplant seedlings bring about a nation? But actually, it's the psychological set, it's the psychological strengthening that makes the difference, and it's indispensable to nation building. The Palestinian who has cast off this old image and put on the new, I must tell you, looks very confident, relaxed, resilient. As one of my fellow delegates said, they're full of grit and pluck, and he's right. The Israeli Jews, on the other hand, have a kind of grim-faced, tight-lipped appearance. And as the director of the International Center for Peace in the Middle East, Willie Gaffney, said, we Jews in Israel were brought up on strength. The problem is that we are strong, but no longer clever. It's the privilege of the weak to use their minds. And his Arab colleague, who is co-director of that Peace Center, just smiled. Now I'd like to show you some slides in the remaining few minutes, and then we'll have time for some questions. I think I'm on remote control, so if I could, maybe we can dim the...